He's an original Brat Pack member synonymous with such iconic films as Pretty in Pink, St. Elmo's Fire, and Less Than Zero. But as actor Andrew McCarthy approaches his 50th birthday, he does it as a different kind of storyteller. In his new travel book, The Longest Way Home, One Man's Quest for the Courage to Settle Down, McCarthy, an editor-at-large at National Geographic Traveler, explores his fear of commitment while scaling Mount Kilimanjaro and trekking through Patagonia. The father of two is still acting, but it is through travel writing that McCarthy ultimately was able to face his emotional demons, including a strained relationship with his father, and overcome his fear of marriage. It's a great pleasure to welcome Andrew McCarthy to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
It is wonderfully written, and it tells a very powerful story. At what point did you realize that your creativity, your art of acting, because we often hear of that, of the transfer from actor to writer, but to you to even take it a step a little bit further and say, I'm going to write, and I'm going to write about my travels?
Well, yeah, it's not the normal career arc that you hear about, actor, travel writer. Well, to answer that, I guess I have to go back. I mean, I'd been acting since I was 18 years old professionally. So in that time, you know, I saw a bunch of the world when I was in my young 20s. And then eventually I started to travel on my own. And I found it filled a need in my life that it just filled something that was looking to be filled, you know. And I found the travel changed my life. You know, I'm one of those people that drank the travel Kool-Aid. And it changed the way I perceived the world. It changed my place in the world. It helped me get over fear, basically. It was the first biggest thing that travel did. And so it became an important part of my life. I would finish a movie and then I would go off to Africa for a couple months alone, or I'd go off to Southeast Asia and I would just buy a ticket in and just wander around, basically, and sort of had this untethered sort of finding of myself, I guess. And eventually it led to me writing about it to myself, just sort of writing and keeping sort of writing stories about it. You know, I tried to keep a journal, but I found that sort of embarrassing and self-indulgent and silly. And so I'm an actor, right? So I started writing scenes of people that I met with dialogue and story arcs and descriptions of places. And I would do that. I did that for about 10 years, really. And I would throw that in a drawer every time I'd come home. And eventually it just sort of asserted itself. And I decided I wanted to sort of add that to what I did. I met an editor at National Geographic Traveler, a guy named Keith Bellows. And I said, you know, I want to write for your magazine. And he said, you're an actor, dude. And I said, yeah, I know, but I know how to tell a story. And that was the right answer. And eventually, you know, after a year of me sort of cajoling him and pushing him and emailing him and pitching him, finally said, you know, he sent me. And I said, look, you know, if you don't like it, you don't pay me. And he said, fine, I can live with that. So I wrote a story and it worked. And then I wrote another and another, and it just spread out from there. I mean, what's underneath every travel story that I write is this notion that travel changed my life, and it can for you too. You know what I mean? So there's this sort of belief under it. I'm not writing about that overtly any time, but that's what's underneath it, you know, and it's given my travel writing some sort of momentum. And then the book was a natural outgrowth of that. So, but I mean, the acting was an initial passion when I was very young, and it saved my life in a big way. And it just happened, and it wasn't anything that I consciously planned. And the travel writing has certainly been an accidental second career. You know, it was a passion that I just pursued, and because I liked to do it. And I wanted to write these articles because I wanted to. There was no reason. Certainly you don't get into magazine writing for money.
Oh, you don't? No.
And, you know, the dollar word doesn't go far. And so anyway, that's a long-winded answer to saying they just sort of emerged, you know?
Well, what I found interesting in reading the book is that there is a theme in the sense of whether it be – you beautifully describe it at the very beginning of the book about your first time on your first film, and you're in Chicago and you're in this room all by yourself, and just being away and that very solitary feeling, and much – like it is, as you mentioned, when you would go off to Africa or wherever by yourself. That solitary act of travel and going somewhere and being with yourself was important.
Yeah, I mean, I find myself when I'm alone. My wife and I have come from the world at exactly opposite directions. She's a bit like, let's have us, and then I can go out and have me. And I'm like, I need me before I can bring that to us. You know what I mean? And so I could, particularly, I guess, with all the acting, and I became a very public figure very young, I wasn't even aware that I had that need until I was traveling, and somehow I felt satisfied and secure. And it was an odd paradox, this sort of sense of security I would have being in very not secure places, you know. But I felt an access to myself that I didn't feel in my daily life at home, you know. And I thought that was an important thing for me to nurture and to sort of own about myself. You know, it helped me grow up. Traveling basically just helped me grow up in a certain way. You know, I was meeting all these responsibilities, and yet in a certain way, I didn't feel I was nurturing something in me that needed to sort of be fed.
At what point did you realize that these travels were more meaningful than just the symbolic act of getting on a plane and going somewhere, that they were indeed saving your life, that they were having a more profound meaning?
You hear people talk about if it doesn't change your life, it wasn't a great trip. But to a degree, that's true. But the first big trip that I took where I really felt something happened to me was I walked across Spain on the old Camino de Santiago, and I had one of those profound experiences that people have occasionally. That seemed to happen, actually, on the Camino a lot. It wasn't a religious experience in any way, but it was quite a personal, powerful one. And, you know, I was in a field of wheat, and I was suddenly broke down, sobbing, and I had this realization that, to a very large degree, you know, it had been fear that ran my life into it. That was a realization to me that nothing has been the same since, really. It was so big that I had no idea that it was the motivating thing behind everything I did, if you know what I mean. It was so all pervasive in me. And so when it came to light, it sort of began to dissolve. And again, and many other trips, things about my character were illuminated to me through travel. It's like my therapy, I suppose.
And how much of it now do you tie it into work, in the sense of, all right, I'm going to go and travel? How much of it is for you? Because obviously there's the solitary travel, there's the work travel, and then there would be the family travel.
Well, now 95% of the travel I do now is for work, you know, because I have a family, and so I can't be traipsing off on my own for a month to go walk across Spain because I feel like it. So nearly all the trips I take now, I took one trip last year for 3 days that was just for myself. But all the trips I do now are for work, really. But that was one of the reasons the book grew out of it, because all the trips in the book were for, ostensibly, and the reason I was going was for magazine articles. And yet I at a certain point, I began to grow frustrated that the real trips that I was having and the real experiences could never be communicated, and it wasn't appropriate to be communicated in a magazine. I was writing about a place in a certain angle of a story I was telling, but the deeply personal stuff that happened always had to be left out. Mm. And so that was one of the really interesting things about writing the book, because I got to write about the real trips that happened, the emotional trips that happened to me. You know, if you read the chapter in the book and then read the corresponding article, they would seem like different people and or different trips, you know. But it's great now. Traveling with my kids is... I took my son to the Sahara for a story I was doing, you know, when he was 8 years old, and had an incredible experience. You know, I take my daughter to Tahiti. We went out, we're out camping in the Wyoming. So traveling with kids and stuff is a very big experience as well, because you see the world sort of through their eyes, like everyone says. But you also get to come to terms with your own sense of anxieties about... When I'm walking around the street in New York, I don't have a great sense of anxiety about parenting. But if I'm out in the wilderness with my kids, suddenly they're asleep in the tent next to me, and I'm laying awake thinking about, am I keeping them safe and things? You know, so all that's – you can't hide, really, when you travel. That's what I love about travel. There's no escape. People talk about travel as this escape. And to me, it's the exact opposite. You're just confronted with yourself when you travel, you know. Wherever you go, there you are, that cliche, you know. So that's what I find most interesting about travel.
Of course, much of the book is, as the title indicates, The Longest Way Home, One Man's Quest for the Courage to Settle Down, was you deciding that you were going to marry your longtime fiancé. Now, there's no mystery to the book in the sense that we know that you got married, but how you got there is really the question mark, and what is so fascinating to read about. Was that a conscious effort to say, I'm going to work on this?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you hit it exactly right. It's not a willy or won't he. It's more of a how willy. that's why right at the beginning I said on the first page that, you know, the book starts with our honeymoon. So there's no sort of false drama, will he get married? I mean, that's not the issue I was trying to address. Yeah, I mean, as I was going on these trips for magazines and newspapers, I implanted in myself the bigger question of this. The idea for the book came to me. I was sitting in the back of a taxi going to the airport to go to Patagonia, which is one of the first trips in the book. And we had just decided to get married finally. And so we were feeling very close and lovey-dovey the way people do when they make those kind of decisions. And I was almost weepy in the back of the cab to be leaving. And yet another part of myself was absolutely thrilled to be going. And I couldn't – and I sat there and said – you jerk. I mean, I couldn't reconcile that notion of myself as I feel this great intimacy and love, and yet on the other part of me, I'm yearning for some solitary something. And so that the question, the book, that became the nugget of the book is how do I reconcile this? How do I bring myself home to myself, to my loved ones? You know, I'm going to do all the right things. I have continued to, you know, I'm raising my children. I'm responsible. I'm doing, paying the bills, doing all this stuff. But emotionally, I would like to be more present in my life. And so I use the trips as a way of asking and trying to answer really that question. You know, so it's this internal sort of quest played out, you know, in Kilimanjaro and down the Amazon and all these kind of places. Because, you know, that is, like I said, that's where I find things out. I wouldn't do well sitting having tea with my friends at the cafe and discussing my internal process. You know, I wouldn't get anywhere. I find that stuff out by, you know, the boots hitting the trail, you know, and that's where I find myself. And so I address that issue of intimacy and commitment and my coming to terms with it with the literal questing, you know.
Andrew McCarthy is with us. The name of the new book is The Longest Way Home, One Man's Quest for the Courage to Settle Down. In the physical act of travel, when those boots are hitting the ground, are you preoccupied by getting, as you say, it confronts you, it's face-to-face. So are you preoccupied with getting from point A to point B or to exploring and finding where you're going? Or do you allow yourself that time when you're on that trail to think and to work through things, to think about things, as many of us do in the shower?
Yeah, maybe I should just take longer showers and I wouldn't have to go. It's a bit like that. It's a bit like the shower, you know. I mean, so much of traveling, particularly solitary traveling, and particularly if I'm traveling for a story, you're doing logistics and, you know, if I'm writing a story, I'm trying to meet people to get quotes and to, you know, to piece my story together and having anxiety about that story coming together.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that going on. And then, you know, and there's the B track in your mind, so constantly sort of humming, like, what is bothering me? What is going on? And why did I suddenly, why is that picture of that little lady sitting there so poignant to me? And then, oh my God, that reminds me of my grandmother and that kind of stuff, you know. So the road sort of assaults us with that stuff if you stay open to it. You know, as I was writing the book, I'm busy actively on the active level, searching for my story, or traveling, you know, around. But I was in the Amazon and this guy was showing me his boat that it wasn't finished. And I'm walking around in the bowels of this boat. And suddenly this memory of my ex-wife comes to me. So in my notes then, and I know that in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about writing this book that's about this theme of my push me, pull you kind of existence. And so I just write in my notepad that, you know, memory of ex-wife, this detail of the thing. So later when I'm thinking about it, I can go, of course, that's why it came to me there. And, you know, I think travel does that. It, memories and things just come bombarding at us. That's when, you know, smells trigger memories, sights do, everything. So I let that musing sort of go on without me, and it happens anyway.
The phrase that you just used that I found fascinating is, if you stay open to it. So you, it seems from even the very beginning, you have stayed relatively open to it, to allow those thoughts to come and to have that B track embed itself.
Well, that's one of the things of being an actor too. You go to all this acting school when you're a kid, and they're always trying to have you be open, be accessible to your impulses and your feelings and these kind of things. And that's how that became my internal language. That's how I function. I'm functioned by feel and by intuition and by perception and not generally logically and analytically. I find if it feels a certain way, I go, okay, then I know. Then there's a knowing as opposed to a reasoning and a decision. When I have to make decisions, I find them very difficult to make. When I give myself the space and for a knowing to occur, it eventually always does. So I try and be that way in my life, because that's how I function best in the world. You know, so it's not particularly a conscious thing at this point. It's just the way I operate in the world, and that trying to be open to that.
Is there an impact, a profound impact, that early success had on you?
Oh, sure. I mean, I've often said I wouldn't wish success on anyone under 30. I became famous in a certain way in my early 20s, you know, 21, 22, that kind of thing. I didn't even have a sense of myself yet. You know, in your 20s like that, you're just forming who you are and all. And so suddenly I was famous, and what that meant to me was primarily women wanted to sleep with me where they didn't not too long before. And so that I was all for that. That was great. But yeah, I think fame changes a person on sort of a cellular level. And I'm certainly a result of having been famous in my early 20s. I don't know what I would have been like otherwise, because it's my life, so I don't have any other perspective on it. But it certainly had a big effect on me. And one, you know, I wasn't the Kennedy where I'm sort of bred for success, and this is how we move forward on this wave of success and how we capitalize and then do altruistic things and then create these opportunities. To me, it was just something that was coming at me, and I was reacting to it usually by fleeing it. So, yeah, I'd say that it had a large effect on me.
You talk in the book early on about the early film work, and you, in writing about the film St. Elmo's Fire, you say that it's a role that fit you better than any other.
Yeah.
How so?
Because it was a guy who really knew what he wanted and yet would never admit what he wanted because he was afraid, and so adopted a persona of sort of knowing detachment and, you know, a wary observer. And I was all that. You know, I don't know how much of it was on the page or how much I just sort of just did that because that was the only way I knew how to do it. I do remember in preparing for that every morning, I would, this is real acting school stuff, but I would sing a song that I was, remember my mother singing when I was very, very young, that made put me in an incredibly vulnerable state that made me just sort of cry every morning before I would go to work. I would sit quietly and sing the song to myself. And from then on, the rest of the day, I felt so exposed that I just had to cover that up. And that's what the character was like. He was a raw wound who covered it up with sort of cynicism and, you know, rotten before it's ripe kind of wisdom. And I understood that completely.
The films that you are so known for, does it surprise you as to their longevity in the sense of how—
It's amazing, isn't it? It's absolutely amazing. But go ahead, finish your question.
Well, I mean, because, look, I'm one of the—I grew up— just at that time, I'm about 5 years younger than you. And, you know, those were the films that we went to. That's what we went to go see. They were defining in so many ways for us, and they're still in nostalgia. But what I find amazing is that so much of the stuff that was, when we go back to it, it just turns out to be crap. And this, much of what you did still has a great meaning and resonance.
Well, thanks. But, it's amazing to me. Certainly at the time, we didn't think, I thought Pretty in Pink at the time was a silly movie about a girl going to a dance. I couldn't imagine that anybody would want to see that movie at the time. I'm wrong again. You know, the legacy that those movies have is just, it's been shocking to me. But I've often asked why, and I don't know, except that they took seriously young people's problems in a way that movies hadn't before. And it was also the first generation of films that people could take home on VHS, whereas instead of seeing a movie once or twice in the theater maybe, you could suddenly, you know, VHS came out around that time, and the people that were renting movies were the young people who went to see those movies, so they could then suddenly watch us 10, 20 times and take ownership of them in a certain way.
Well, and we could get in. You weren't old enough to get into the theater. You could get them at home.
Right. And, yeah, so I don't know why, you know. I mean, it's lovely and it's sort of surprising to me. I mean, these people asked me to do a tweet up on Weekend at Bernie's, which I hadn't seen in 25 years. And so I watched it along with people while tweeting along with them. And I just thought, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. But I found myself laughing wonderfully, you know, at it. It's so silly. And innocent in a certain way. Those movies, I don't know. They had a real authenticity about them, that an uncynical embracing of the dilemma of growing up that movies didn't have before that. And after that, they got very hip and very cynical. Those movies were not cynical in any way. And there's nothing cynical about being 22 and 18 and the struggle and what it feels, the pain of that. It feels all-consuming, you know, and it's so big, and it's the only pain in the world is your pain when you're that young. And those movies really embrace that sensation.
What are you, when you look back, acting-wise, what are you proud of?
I'm proud of all those movies. You know, I think I was talking about this to my wife just the other day because I saw someone sent me a photo from the time I was filming Pretty in Pink, and I looked at it, and I just looked so young, for one, but I looked at, had this thrill of being alive that you have when you're a kid. I'm a much better actor now, but and yet there's something in those early movies, and in everyone's early films, you look back at some early Tom Hanks movie you come across on TV, there's something when they're very, very young, the thrill of being alive and is so potent and powerful in young people in those things that I don't have that anymore. With Tom Hanks, no one has it once they grow up. Right. So there's something in those, in that youthfulness that is so contagious, and you just want, yeah, I want to be in the room with that. You know what I mean? And it's this delight. You know, the acting work in a lot of those films, I'm not so sure about, but there is that essence of sheer joy and audacity that is hard to resist, you know? But to answer your question directly, I love it. A film I did with Claude Chabrol called Quiet Days in Clichy. I don't think it was ever seen here. And I think Heaven Help Us, an early film I did in that period, was a lovely movie.
It would seem a logical next step for you to write a novel.
I had been writing a novel for a number of years. And when I was about to go out with it, when I had the idea, the sort of sudden flash for this book, and there seemed an urgency to write this book because I also wanted, I knew, what's it, the Joan Didion line that sort of misquoting her, that I know what I'm thinking once I write it down, you know, that kind of thing. And this was the sort of dilemma of this book, of Longest Way Home, is one I was looking to solve. And I knew that writing about it would help me solve it. And I knew I was going on these trips for work that were perfect sort of setup for that, climbing Kilimanjaro and doing these kind of things. So anyway, the long answer is I had a novel that's mostly finished, which I will try and inflict on the world very soon. But this book asserted itself very quickly, and so I put that aside. And I think the novel actually will be helped by having been put aside for a while.
Room to breathe.
Yeah, I mean, I've been working on it for a number of years, and I think now I can go back to it with a little less preciousness and sort of, you know, you have to be able to shake it really hard and nothing fall out of it. You know what I mean?
Indeed. So, the name of the book is The Longest Way Home, One Man's Quest for the Courage to Settle Down. It is published by Free Press. Andrew McCarthy, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us, and best of luck with this and the future work as well.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.